Ani bonjour, tanse, sego, wache, and hello. You are listening to Indigenous Waves Radio Show on CIUT 89.5 FM, and it is a beautiful day to be Indigenous. Just to tell you a little bit about our radio show, Indigenous Waves is a celebration of Indigenous cultures, locally, nationally, and globally, through music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor. We explore the diversity of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous Waves is heard every Monday at 4 p.m. on CIUT. My name is Susan Blight, and our show is produced by Indigenous Waves executive producer, Jemias DaCosta. Our news is prepared by Aruna Boodram, and our events listings by Christine Smith. The track that opened our show is Electric Powwow Drum from A Tribe Called Red. That is DJ Indian, DJ Shub, and DJ Bear Witness. On today's Indigenous Waves, Algonquin Anishinaabe Kwe Lynn Gale will be joining us to discuss, among other things, the recovery and resurgence of Indigenous knowledge, the responsibilities of allies, and wampum diplomacy. We also have your news and events and a couple of great tunes from Indigenous artists. Our first guest, Lynn Gale, is Algonquin Anishinaabe Kwe from the Ottawa River Valley, Ontario, Canada. Lynn describes herself as a learner-researcher, a thinker, writer, blogger, and she has been an Indigenous human rights advocate for 27 years. Lynn works to eliminate the continued sex discrimination in the Indian Act, and she is also an outspoken critic of the contemporary land claims and self-government process, what many call the contemporary treaty process. She has a doctorate in Indigenous studies, a Master of Arts in Canadian and Native Studies, and an undergraduate degree in anthropology. She also has a diploma in chemical technology and worked for the Ontario Ministry of the Environment for 12 years in the area of toxic organic analysis of Ontario's waterways. While advocating for change, she is currently part of what she does. She is also interested in traditional knowledge systems that guide the Anishinaabeg forward to a good life. And I do believe Lynn joins us by telephone. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Kwe Kwe. Thank you for having me.
Bonjour. Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really like your work and so happy to have you on the phone today.
Thank you.
We do have a lot to talk about, so I'm going to get right to my first question. In your blog post titled On Indigenous Knowledge, you write about how non-Indigenous allies, their interest and involvement in Indigenous knowledge, it can become appropriative, invasive, and actually hinder the work that needs to be done in Indigenous communities. Are you able to speak a little bit about that, Lynn?
Yes, certainly. My goal is to encourage people to go back to their own Indigenous knowledge and stop interfering with other people's Indigenous knowledge. So we all have it, and we all have work to do.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I did read that on your blog that you write that all people have Indigenous knowledge, which you just referenced, and it's very interesting. Are you able to clarify what you mean when you write that all people, including people of European descent, have Indigenous knowledge?
Yes, I think most people might understand it as their cultural knowledge and their cultural traditions, their foods and their medicines and their songs and their rituals and their ceremonies. That is a body of knowledge that I call their Indigenous knowledge. It's their original language, and it's usually land-based knowledge, and it's knowledge that they brought with them over from the other world, to Turtle Island. So they do have their own, just as we have our own. So a lot of people think that Indigenous knowledge is only land, defined by land, and it's local, and that's not necessarily true. And they will use that as an excuse to say, well, we have to learn the local Indigenous knowledge. Certainly, they do need to respect the local Indigenous knowledge, but that doesn't mean that they can leave their Indigenous knowledge behind or not do that journey, go on that journey that Indigenous people to Turtle Island or many of us have returned to.
I see. And on your blog, you talk about that, and you talk about the importance of Indigenous knowledge and how you define that. Are you able to talk, to elaborate for our listeners, about the importance of Indigenous knowledge and what happens if someone is divorced from their Indigenous knowledge?
Okay, what was the first part of the question?
Well, can you talk a little bit about the importance of Indigenous knowledge, I guess, in people's lives, how the prominence of it and the importance of it to people's lives and how they behave. And if you could also talk about what happens in the absence of that Indigenous knowledge?
Mm-hmm. The importance of Indigenous knowledge, I think that's the knowledge that keeps you home, keeps you grounded, and keeps you safe, and keeps you company when you most need it. So it's knowledge that directs you and guides your thinking and your agency, your emotions. And devoid of it, you become very vulnerable to other forms of knowledge, such as shopping, for example, to fulfill that void. So I think it's really, really important ontologically. It's the core of who you are as a person, as a human being. Without it, I think we end up in a lot of trouble. And so I think what happens when people are divorced from it, I think that they get caught up in rituals and ceremonies that may not be, that are not sustainable, such as shopping or overeating or pollution, refuge production, things like that. So it's really important that we hang on to our Indigenous knowledge and value it for what it is and not let capitalism or materialism take over that space and that importance of it.
Mm-hmm. In reference to what we understand as Indigenous knowledge here on Turtle Island or even within what is now known as Canada, non-Indigenous allies do seek out that knowledge. We know this. We've all seen it. And in that same article titled On Indigenous Knowledge, which is on your blog, you write in reference to non-Indigenous people, and this is a quote, Lynn, if you really want to do contemporary Indigenous knowledge work, such as address some of the injustices imposed on us, help Indigenous women as we define help to be, not as you define help to be, which I thought was really profound and really important. Are you able to elaborate a bit on that quote, Lynn?
Yes, I think what a lot of people have a tendency to do is they want to offer help, but they define what is help. And what they don't realize is that that sometimes their definition of help is a barrier, and it's not what we need, it's not what we want. I think it's really important that if you want to be an ally to Indigenous people and serve Indigenous people, you have to be a genuine ally with us, not an ally that serves your need. And so we need to be able to, Indigenous people need to define it. The metaphor I use is that you need to follow the turtle. You need to let the person who is most oppressed define what the help is, and you need to stand behind them.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of really important work around allies and their relationship to Indigenous people. You drafted a document entitled The Ally Bill of Responsibilities, and in that document you outline the responsibilities that allies must honor in working with Indigenous people and Indigenous communities. Are you able, Lynn, to talk a little bit about the Ally Bill of Responsibilities and perhaps how you hope it will be used?
Yes. Thank you. As you had mentioned when you were introducing me, I'm in the middle of an Algonquin land claim and self-government process. We've been in that process for about 20 years. And also I have a charter challenge regarding Section 6 of the Indian Act, that it continues to engage in sex discrimination. And so sitting in that context for a long time, like almost 30 years now, I've had a lot to think about, and I've had a lot of experience of people interfering, thinking they're doing good things, and a lot of non-Indigenous people benefiting from the industry of the land claim process. And sitting in that process, it was actually a very, very, very difficult place to be in. What I ended up doing after I had been really hurt really badly by somebody who thought they were doing a good thing is I sat down and I drafted the Ally Bill of Responsibilities, and I really put a lot of effort into thinking about it, drawing from my experience, and I asked a lot of people some their thoughts on it. And then I realized that I needed to have a really evocative title, and in order to make it accessible, I had to make it easy, you know, easy to grasp, easy for it to gain currency. So I gave it that evocative title, mm-hmm. and then I just numbered things that I think are important for allies to know about and to think about if that's what they want to do, serve Indigenous people, and if that's what they want to do, engage in a solidarity movement with us.
Yeah, and I think, I was thinking about it over the weekend, and I was thinking about sort of the advent of Idle No More, the prominence of Idle No More, and how the Ally Bill of Responsibilities and outlining what those are becomes especially important when I guess people who aren't normally invested in Indigenous issues become aware of some of these things.
Yes, when I Don't Know More took off, I took my document and I gave it a lot of currency on Facebook because I thought it's a useful guide. I mean, certainly it's not a law. I'm not a law writer. It would be good if I could write laws, but that's not the case. So it's really just a guide to help people and to get them to think critically about their actions and their practices. Some people take a very literal interpretation of some of the issues, and again, it's just a guide. And I think a lot of people have told me it's an excellent guide. They've gained a lot from it. So, for example, the need not to act out of guilt and the need for them to be rooted in their own culture. They are really important when they're trying to be allies to Indigenous people, because we really don't need people draining us because they have cultural laws or Indigenous knowledge laws.
Right, exactly. Do you, this Ally Bill of Responsibilities and the things that we're discussing sort of go hand in hand with a lot of your work around the protection of Indigenous knowledge. And as I mentioned, in many ways, the advent and prominence of Idle No More, we have seen a lot of interest from people not normally invested in that, in Indigenous issues, for lack of a better word. Are you... if, let's say, media sources, for instance, want to sort of go looking for information or want to do a story on something around Indigenous knowledge, can you talk a little bit about how they might do that in a respectful and an ethical way?
Yes. I think that's a great question. I just had a really bad experience. I watched a news documentary/news story, and the first thing that I was quite surprised about is there was no women on the panel.
Oh.
I was really quite surprised about that, and gender balance is fundamental. And some of the men were Indigenous men, some were not Indigenous men, and I was really quite surprised that the men themselves didn't say, if there's no women on the panel, I really don't want to be talking.
Yeah.
I was quite shocked about that, and I'm referring to both Indigenous and non-Indigenous men. But I also find what's really, really important is people need to really think critically about the economic model that is hegemonic, that is governing all that we do. A lot of times I'm finding the questions are emerging from a Western economic model. And the formulation of your questions needs to move from an Indigenous perspective, which is earth-based and understanding that it's not about profit. I think that's really important.
Yeah. One question that I really wanted to ask you, Lynn, was I read your article, Protecting the Recovery, Revitalization, and Resurgence of Indigenous Knowledge. And in that article, you wrote... you wrote as a statement, avoid elder essentialism, which is the thought and practice that only elders hold Indigenous knowledge. Elder essentialism is a form of idolatry, is dangerous, and interferes. So that goes back a little bit to my question about the idea of all people having Indigenous knowledge. Are you able to elaborate a bit on that point and how believing that only elders hold Indigenous knowledge interferes with the recovery of Indigenous knowledge?
Yes, I think that's really important, that everyone seems to think elders are the only people that hold Indigenous knowledge, and that's not true. I mean, children hold Indigenous knowledge, they're dancers, they're language speakers, or hunters, they hold Indigenous knowledge, women, they hold Indigenous knowledge, they're raising children, and they're taking care of the house and doing the things that they need to do, taking care of the land, that definitely is Indigenous knowledge. I think it's really important that we think about that critically, and what is an elder as well, because an elder is not somebody who turns 60. An elder is so much more. I think in defining Indigenous knowledge, I think we need to understand that it predates human arrival. And a lot of people wrestle with that, but, the stars and the sun, they predated, humans, and that's important. And the same goes with trees and the animals. They have knowledge, and the humans may not be able to tap into it. And we do learn from them by observing them. And I think, what else would I say about it? Indigenous knowledge, it sits closer to natural law. At least it tries to. It tries to honor that that natural law and value it and live as close as it can be to natural law, which is quite different than, for example, the economic model that we currently live under, which is more about destroying the earth and honoring the earth and honoring natural law. And also, indigenous knowledge, it has a moral code. I actually like to say a lot, I say it a lot, that the economic model is void of a moral code, and that's the biggest issue, one of the biggest issues we have. So I think it is not only elders that hold indigenous knowledge, and it is not only in the land, it's also in the stars and then the sun and then the animals and then the trees.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just going to say, Lynn, we're getting a little bit of feedback. So I'm not sure if you have your radio on or you're close to a radio, but if you could just sort of put some distance between yourself and that, or turn down the volume so that we can hear your words, that would be great.
Okay, not near. I don't have anything on, but I'll speak up louder.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay. We'll just try to figure that out as we go along, but I'm going to get to the next question, Lynn.
Okay.
In that same article, and this was something I was so intrigued by, you address the issue of community membership. You write, "To people who argue a dream vision told them they are from a particular indigenous nation, and people who argue they saw a photograph where their ancestor looks like so-and-so is a rationale for interfering. This does not constitute concrete community membership." So this really goes to the idea of citizenship and criteria for citizenship in indigenous nations or communities, which I think is an area where there might be a lack of writing and thought and critical thinking on that. So I'm wondering, Lynn, if you're able to talk about that, about perhaps your opinion on the criteria for citizenship in an indigenous nation.
Well, again, I wrote that, my Indigenous Knowledge Protection Act, from my experience, because, and so when I came up with that criteria, I'm talking about people who can't concretely claim who they are as an Algonquin person, but yet they allude to it, or they claim to be it, and they get a lot of currency, they gain a lot of currency, but they really can't concretely say, "I'm an Algonquin." And that becomes an interference, because somebody who can concretely and confidently claim who they are as an Algonquin person, their words may not be heard. And I think also we need to understand is that everyone has indigenous knowledge, and if your parents are Irish, then claim that knowledge as indigenous knowledge. I think criteria for citizenship, well, that becomes really difficult. I do believe there is adoption. But in the modern world, I think a lot of people who are claiming to be adopted, they just get kind of pushed aside or almost mocked at. So in some ways, I think in the contemporary world, adoption has a lot of limitations. It's not like it was 300-400 years ago when we could adopt and assimilate somebody into our community.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see that. So we're really talking about sort of the idea of being from an indigenous nation or having ancestral roots there, but also a sort of community criteria in on some level. Is that kind of what we're thinking about, Lynn?
I'm not so sure about the community criteria. I think in the modern world you have to be able to claim who you are and be confident about who you are. Community acceptance isn't enough in the contemporary world. Mm-hmm. Because you will be just mocked at, you will be just pushed aside, and what you have to say in terms of the Algonquin land claims self-government process won't really be valued and respected, because you're not even a community member type of thing, right?
Yeah.
You can't prove who you are. So in that way, community acceptance, it's more than a paradox. In some ways, it's a barrier. So I think we have to remember that community adoption today isn't the same as it was, again, 300-400 years ago when a person could confidently claim who they were.
Yes, I see that. I'm conscious of time, Lynn, so I do want to get to a couple of questions around your work with wampum diplomacy. In Canada's Constitutional Beginnings Through Wampum, that's an article, again, from your blog, you write about the creation of Canada and the fiction of two founding nations. I think this is such an important point. Lynn, can you let our listeners know why the idea of two founding nations in Canada is erroneous?
Well, the French and the French and British people, they came here from another world, whereas, you know, Turtle Island was full of indigenous people, full of nations. So it's just a story that gained a lot of currency.
Yeah. As a lot of people still believe that.
Yes, and that's because of an effective education system that talks to people and teaches them about the two founding nations. Now, there's nothing wrong with these two founding nations, but there are indigenous nations here. And we are supposed to be engaging in nation-to-nation relationships. So I think that's what I want to say about that.
you have done a lot of important work around the relationship of wampum to the creation of Canada. You write how the giving and receiving of various wampum solidified a nation-to-nation relationship between many Indigenous nations and what eventually became the Canadian government. Are you able to speak a bit about the British and Western Great Lakes Covenant Chain Confederacy Wampum Belt, the 24 Nations Wampum Belt, the Two-Row Wampum, and the relationship of those to the 1763 Royal Proclamation?
Yes, because Canada's history is, Canada teaches, you know, about two founding nations. They don't talk about the Treaty at Niagara, which is where Canada's constitutional documents were ratified. The Royal Proclamation was ratified there through the use of wampum diplomacy and those three belts. And those three belts, collectively, they talk about a nation-to-nation relationship where Indigenous peoples and the newcomers, the settlers, were going to share the land and the resources equally, and they were going to respect one another's cultural traditions and governance traditions.
And so this idea of nation to nation, the idea of independent, that Indigenous nations would have sovereignty over their lands and these kinds of things that were contained within that, why do you think the majority of Canadians are ignorant to that fact, that these wampum belts, form the basis for Canada's first constitutional documents? It doesn't seem like something that's well known.
No, I think, again, there's many reasons. First of all, Indigenous culture was criminalized from, I think it was 1880s to 1951. It was criminalized and pushed underground, but also Canada's history in the education system teaches about the French and the British. They don't teach about the Indigenous nations. And when people think about our culture, Indigenous cultures and Indigenous knowledge, they think of fluffs and feathers. They don't think it's really sophisticated and valid. And they don't really value wampum diplomacy as a traditional form of symbolic literacy that encodes knowledge. It's seen as just beads on a string. But in actual fact, it's a very sophisticated form of codifying knowledge that has not been given the currency and the respect that it needs.
Yes. Lynn, on your blog, you write that you have woven new editions of these three historic wampum belts. Are you able to speak about that process and what your hopes are for that bundle?
Yes, I made that bundle as part of my doctoral process. I was given some tobacco and asked to learn about the Treaty at Niagara and the three wampum belts, and I took that on. And I'm a particular kind of learner thinker. I have to do things versus just read literature. And through the process of learning, I decided to sit down and remake these wampum belts. The originals, we're not quite sure where they are or what happened to them. And so I ended up making the three wampum belts, and my brother actually gifted me with bear fur and a moose hide, and I feasted it, and now it's a bundle. I carry it around and have accepted the responsibility of it, and I give teachings and I share it with people and I feast it. I take it out when people ask me to take it out, and I really enjoy doing it. I try and work from, well, I do work from memory, so I try and take a traditional approach where I'm not reading paper or English text. I'm reading the wampum belts the way they would have been read traditionally and historically, and I just read it recently in Peterborough to about 60 people.
Wow. That is so beautiful. Like the, as you're explaining, and I did read the story as well on your blog. You, I want to let our listeners know that you can go to Lynn's blog, which is called Blackface Blog, and read these stories that she's read the full text of what she's telling us today. But it's so beautiful to that you're doing this. I don't know that I've seen something like this done very frequently.
Thank you. And it's really important because this year marks the 250th anniversary of the Royal Proclamation and the Treaty at Niagara. Yeah. And I had many, many traditional speakers, teachers, you know, like John Burroughs and Alan Corbier. And I really enjoyed making it, and I really enjoy the responsibility of having it.
Yes. Can you let our listeners know, Lynn, this is my last question for you today, are you able to let our listeners know a bit about your book, which is called Anishinaabeg Stories, featuring petroglyphs and wampum belts? So can you let our listeners know a little bit about the book and where it's available?
Yes, thank you. Okay, it's my first book, and it's right out of the box. It's written for community people, so it's large. It has a larger font, and it has photographs in it as well as diagrams. It has 13 chapters for 13 moons, and even has 3 crossword puzzles. You can get it from my website at www.lynngale.com. It sold for $19.95, and I use the funding to help the process I'm going through with my charter challenge regarding the Indian Act. And I feature a lot of the petroglyphs and petroglyphs in it. They help me tell the story. And they're all traditional stories, so I start with the creation story, and I move on to the Tree Nation, and then I talk about wampum diplomacy. And I place women, I place women in the center, and, remaining and with my Algonquin tradition, I do a lot of, put a lot of the Algonquin issues in there. So it's a special book. I really love my book.
Well, we are going to put your blog up, the link to your blog, on our Twitter and our Facebook, so people can get more information on your writing, your work, and everything that you do, as well as buy your book. I do want to take this moment to thank you, Lynn, for joining us today and talking to us about these really important issues and for your great work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I hope you stay in touch with Indigenous Waves. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. We were just speaking with Lynn Gale about a variety of things. She was on the phone to talk about the revitalization and recovery of Indigenous knowledge, about wampum diplomacy and its relationship to the Canadian Constitution, about allies and their responsibilities in working with Indigenous people and Indigenous communities. We're going to go to a song on Indigenous Waves. What you're going to hear is We Are Still Here, and this is Spirit Nation. I'd just like to remind you, you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and the show is Indigenous Waves.
Continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Bonjour, welcome back to the show. This is Indigenous Waves Radio Show on CIUT 89.5 FM, and these are your news and events. Bella Bella, Central BC. The remote community of Bella Bella on the central coast of BC is reeling after its main community building, housing the only grocery store and post office, was destroyed in a fire early Friday. Bella Bella is on Campbell Island on Llama Passage in the Great Bear Rainforest. It has no road access to the mainland. Described as the gateway to the rainforest, the community has a BC Ferries terminal and an airport, with regular flights to Port Hardy on Vancouver Island, which is 181 kilometers to the south. No one was injured in the fire that started sometime around 3 a.m., said Marilyn Slett, chief counselor for the Hatsook First Nation, which owns the building. It's devastating to our community, Slett explained. It's the heart of our community. It's a bit surreal right now. She said the province's third largest First Nations community of 2,500 is rallying to support the cleanup efforts. Our primary concerns are restoring the essential services to our community, she said. We're trying to set up plans for our staff, she said. It employs a lot of people in our community. We have to look at people who are supporting their families. Sergeant Glenn Caston of the Bella Bella RCMP said police are investigating the cause of the fire. It was a suspicious fire, he said. We don't have a cause for the fire. That's what I mean by suspicious. He said that the fire was absolutely devastating for the community. He called it an important meeting place in Bella Bella. This is a very resilient community, he said. There are plans already to get past this. And Fisher River Cree Nation, Manitoba. After facing $800 in electricity bills in the winter, a lot is about to change in Peguis and Fisher River Cree Nation because of a geothermal energy pilot project being put into action by Aki Energy. Aki is an Ojibwe word meaning the relationship that people have with Mother Earth. These geothermal energy projects provide fuel and heat for homes at an increased comfort level, and because of the way that it works with the Earth's thermal levels, it's a lot cleaner fuel than the dry heat. They say that it will provide more affordable and efficient heating in the winter and cooling in the summer, and while it's a greener way to fuel homes, it also fits into the Ojibwe worldview. Lloyd Stevenson from Peguis First Nation explained that it's how you keep the balance with how you live and how you respect and don't damage the gifts Mother Earth has given to us. Some residents already have the geothermal units installed in their homes. Their bills have drastically decreased from $800 to $80 a month. Sean Loney from Aki Energy also thinks these projects are important because it is helping address the employment crisis that is currently plaguing many of these communities. He says that they think that the best way to deal with these employment issues is to work within the local economy, which means employing the people of the community to serve and build that community. Aki Energy has employed over 30 people from Peguis First Nation and trained them with skills that could provide them with lifelong opportunities. They hope to provide 300 homes with geothermal energy within the next 3 years. They were recently approved to work with another 6 First Nations communities across Manitoba. And keeping with their hope of working with the local economy, they project that those other nations will have geothermal energy homes up and running by next year. Gonesitake Mohawk Territory. On the 23rd anniversary of what has become known as the 1990 Oka Crisis, 100 people gathered at Oka Park on traditional territory of the Ganyaga-Aga Mohawk people of Gonesitage to mark what organizers called the start of a new battle against unauthorized development on Mohawk land. We have neglected this battle against unauthorized development on Mohawk land. Sorry, we have neglected this part of our territory, thinking that what the white man calls a reservation is where we're entitled to live. Today we see the exploitation, appropriation of our lands by companies like Enbridge, who already have their pipes in the park, by Gazuduk, who fracked without our knowledge, said Ellen Gabriel, a member of the Ganyaga-Aga Nation, Turtle Clan, in an outspoken voice in favor of Indigenous sovereignty. And so it's really important that today this be the beginning of many kinds of demonstrations from our people, not just Mohawks, but all people. We only have one planet. We must protect Mother Earth, and that's what this is about. The rally not only marked the anniversary of the Oka Crisis, but also served to send a message to oil company Enbridge about their unapproved excursion into Gonesitake territory to inspect their oil pipeline running through the town of Mirabel, Quebec. The inspection, which includes drilling deep into the ground, is part of Enbridge's preparation to reverse the flow of this pipeline known as Line 9. The change in direction will allow the company to pump oil from west to east rather than the current east to west, giving them the ability to move oil from Alberta all the way to ports on the east coast. The reversal is currently being reviewed by National Energy Board and is already being met by large amounts of protest and criticism. Many other groups were present to express their support and to speak out against Enbridge's plans, including Idle No More Quebec, the Montreal chapter of the Council of Canadians, Greenpeace, and Climate Justice Montreal. Following the speeches, people at the protest decided to move to the street. Led by a trio of Mohawk women drummers, they walked to Highway 344, which runs past the park, and started a round dance. Traffic on the busy road was significantly slowed down. As one of the organizers with Idle No More Quebec said, it sent a strong message. You can no longer pass us by without recognizing and respecting our presence. And your events, July 15th from 7 p.m. to July 31st at 9 p.m., the Silent Voices of Neskantagat Candlelight Vigil. This is taking place at Bates Etune at 612 Markham Street, Toronto. And July 15th to the 19th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Native Canadian Center Summer Cultural Day Camp. This is for children ages 6 to 12 years old. To register, or if you have any questions, please call 416-964-9087, extension 315, or email denise.booth@nctcon.ca. There is a $10 registration fee per family. And Saturday, July 20th at 10 a.m., the third annual Shameless Magazine Yard Sale. If you live in the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, join Shameless Mag on Saturday, July 20th for their annual yard sale. This year, in addition to the amazing items for sale, there will also be live music and cold drinks. It's more than just a yard sale, it's a summer event. All proceeds from the yard sale go to support Shameless Magazine. The location is 862 College Street. They are also accepting donations to the sale, a maximum of 10 items per donor. For more information, please contact Joe, that's J-O, at shamelessmag.com. And July 24th at 6:45 p.m., come to a discussion on alternatives to tar sands. This is organized by East End Against Line 9. This is an open discussion led by Brian Dale, followed by a planning session for a community forum on the Line 9 pipeline project. The location is Center 55 Community Center, 97 Main Street, just south of Girard. That's three stops south of the main subway on Main Bus number 64. And July 27th to July 28th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Ojibwe Language and Culture Camp. Join the Center for Aboriginal Initiatives, Indigenous Languages Initiative. Lunch will be provided, and the event is open to any and all, and it is free of charge. Children must be accompanied by their guardians, but families are encouraged to participate. The Multi-Faith Center is the location, and that is at 569 Spadina Avenue in Toronto. For more details or to register, please contact Connor Pion at indigenous.languages@utoronto.ca. And I do want to send a thank you to Aruna Boodram for preparing our news today, as well as Chrissy Smith for our events. Thank you both. We are going to go to a song on Indigenous Waves. What you're going to hear is Chris Dirksen, and this is War Cry Movement. This station is CIUT, and you are currently listening to Indigenous Waves Radio Show. Thank you.
כל מו פני וואו חיה משטב שואלי כן
מאס קטש מתייש יפה פיה מסוק קטש שחל לפוקס שכונה סטואטית לנתנה ואדם איב וקריסל קטנה תמו ממלי זה
Bonjour, welcome back to Indigenous Waves Radio Show on CIUT 89.5 FM. You just heard a set of songs. We started with War Cry Movement from Chris Dirksen. We followed with OG Style from Morningstar River. And then Crowhop, a Crowhop from Black Lodge Singers. And we ended that set with Miss Christy Lee, and that track was called Experience. Kind of a cool track. She raps in her Musqueam dialect on that track, so that's kind of awesome, having the Indigenous language aspect. If you missed any of our songs today or missed our playlist, please do check us out on social media. You can follow us on Twitter at Indigenous Waves, all one word. You can friend us on Facebook or like our fan page, which is Indigenous Waves Radio Show. Other than that, you can go to our website, and we always do archive our shows a little bit later in the week. We put our shows up that you can stream online, as well as list our playlist if you want to get any of the great music that we do play on our show every week. I want to take this moment to thank our guest today, Lynn Gale, for being on the show. She had a lot of really great information to share, which is just a bit of a microcosm of everything that she's written on her blog and in other things. So please do seek her out online to read some of her, to read the full text of some of her articles, because I think it's really critical and crucial reading for everybody, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. So thank you to Lynn Gale for joining Indigenous Waves today. I also want to thank our executive producer, Jemias DaCosta, our news editor, Aruna Boudram, and our events editor, Chrissy Smith. Thanks for being such a great team and for holding it down all the time. And most of all, of course, our listeners for the continued support. Please do continue to comment on our website, like and share our website posts, comment to us on Twitter and on Facebook, and share and like on those sites. We do appreciate it. We're going to end the week with Kizzy IMC, one of our favorites. This is World So Beautiful. We will be back on this station at 4 p.m. next Monday, so please do join us on CIUT 89.5 FM, and please do stay tuned for the Taylor Report. This has been Indigenous Waves Radio Show.
Yo, what's up? This is Keese IMC representing the Skeety Pawnee, Wolf Band of the Pawnee, the Nogazee, Bear Clan of the Seminole, Culture Shock Camp, representing my people all over, indigenous people, human beings, all worldwide. This is live here on Indigenous Waves 89.5. Doodah hey, daw daw, chikso, idiwait daw hey, hidi mahi, I hope.
If the feeling's mutual and you feel it and it's fruitful, cause the breath of life I was given is the breath of life I'm given. This goes out to my people who have passed and are living. I traveled on this road and this road has been a blessing. I've learned so many lessons but I kept them second guessing. Always and forever through endeavors, never forgetting who I am and where I come from, cause I was always stretching the limits and the bounds, cause no border kept me down. Lost friends along the way, but along the way is when I found that the journey and the outcome is when I learned and found some purpose to my fountains, magnetic shows and albums. An outcast and castaway, and never asked to stay, but it never mattered because I always had something to say. When people try to bash me, I'll number and I'll match me, but come on, geek, goody doo, they can never catch me. The bringer of the light told me once I'm in the night that they try to take your peace, and your peace is how you fight. So I'm fighting for my peace, and the peace of land is fighting, fighting for our people through our actions and our writings. You probably heard many times before. We young reservation kid growing up real poor again, of course. They think he's not gonna make it while he's hanging with his older cousins, so he starts tricking, but it's not what you're thinking. He was blessed with the mark, how they dance sprinkled on his forehead and across his heart is the truth. Been chosen as a youth from the medicine man Abraham is the root, so I shoot for the stars. It's just in my heart, I do it for my father cause he's like behind bars. I do it for my moms, I sing for songs in honor of the great spirits. Life side is strong, so be strong. No need for alcohol in the system. Thanks to my brother, cause he gave me a lot of wisdom. The evil in the world, we try to stay above it.
TVs and chill,
cause